Who lasts?
Good evening. It's Panacea Health Program coming out on Tuesday night. I'm Quentin Strawley. And on tonight's program, we look at the rise of clean eating posts on Instagram, how we can deal with scrap on soil and worms, and how do we create a smoke-free workplace without any repercussions. And believe it or not, type 2 diabetes can be handled by D3. All coming up in the next half hour. Stay tuned, please. Just on the morning program, spoke to Peter Carroll, a pioneer of sustainable education in Australia and the founder of the NGO Scrap. Scrap is a non-profit organisation based in southwestern Sydney, and since 1991, this thrifty NGO has been helping Australians from all walks of life divert resources from going to waste. Scrap is currently facilitating a recycling programme of diverting organic refuse from going to a landfill at Holsworthy High School.
Now, what are the aims of Scrap? Tell us about the organisation.
Sure. Well, in the broadest sense, we've always worked to try and develop practical solutions in environmental education. We've worked primarily with schools, but we work with all comers, whoever's interested. And originally, as the name actually suggests, it's an acronym standing for School Communities Recycling All Paper. As teachers, we focused on the importance of bringing practical solutions that would benefit the environment and embedding that in the education within schools. So we started the first ever paper recycling program in New South Wales schools, and that eventually became embedded in a government contract and, of course, continues today. As everyone's pretty familiar with, it's right across our community, and it was an outstanding success in its day to bring many hundreds, if not thousands, of organisations into the network of paper recycling and thereby reducing waste on average by about 30%.
Gosh, how did you become involved with environmental education? What led you down this path?
Well, I'm a bit of an old fella, and I went to university in the 1970s and became involved in the anti-uranium movement to try and stop nukes, of course, as part of the peace issue, and also to end uranium mining, which we've not been successful in, but, you know, there is a fair consciousness left in Australia about that issue. And from there, as a teacher education student, I eventually went out into schools and realised how lacking we were in environmental education in our schools, and sought with colleagues to try and change that over the years until eventually we had the opportunity to start Scrap.
You mentioned before the paper recycling initiative and how amazingly successful that has been. What other initiatives have Scrap been involved with over the year?
Yeah, so at one stage we were a moderately large organisation for a small NGO. We had about 15 people, educators. I had a truck on the road collecting recyclables, and we expanded that recycling program by developing waste auditing in schools. So we'd get the kids donned up in their gloves and their work clothes, and we would actually separate out and weigh and record the amount of waste that was produced in a school over one day. And we've done that in hundreds of schools over the years, and it has a kind of shock factor, you know. There's that yuck factor for kids when they're separating the waste. They realise, you know, how awful it is when you don't separate out your resources. Everything gets messed up, and that's why it ends up in landfill. Whereas if you separate it, as we are beginning to understand, particularly the organic fraction can be turned into compost, which of course is a valuable soil conditioner. And today we focus very much on worm farming and composting and gardening, and that in itself in schools can be as much as another 40% of the total waste as our audit showed over the years.
That's
we
amazing.
Went on to do a major sustainable schools program, which ran for many years, which had five forms of auditing in it that we worked on with schools over a full day, and then came back with a whole environmental management plan, which they could, you know, with recommendations gradually implement over time. We've focused on selling into schools recycled options for things like paper, toilet paper. We have even refillable whiteboard markers, you know, it goes right through the whole scale of school purchasing, and businesses can become involved in that as well and reform their purchasing habits so that we're buying less throwaway materials and instead looking always for the reuse, the avoidance of landfilling and recycling wherever possible.
I feel like I feel like when you give children the opportunity to learn and you give them the opportunity to make these choices, they will always astound you. They will always be so much more receptive and so much more kind of attuned to what you're trying to teach them than you could ever imagine. Kids are incredible, and getting to them at that young age and embedding those sustainable practices and really educating those sustainable practices, I think, is so, so important and so, so fantastic. Tell us about the program currently happening at Holsworthy High School.
Okay, so at Holsworthy, where we're based in southwestern Sydney in the Liverpool area, we have a centre which is based around sustainable principles. So we recycled an old army barracks. We have a dozen large worm farms. We've got compost bays, compost bins, various forms of it. We have a complete water conservation system with water tanks, grey water system, composting toilet. We're solar powered, so it's a living example of sustainability that anyone can come and visit, and we run people through various programs. So at the moment, we've just received some funding from Liverpool Council to launch a program that I've been writing submissions for nearly 10 years,
wow,
which is called Table to Table Organic Living Skills. And in that, we take a group of young students from high school and put them through a process where they appreciate food at the table. The waste material is then, of course, redirected through composting and worm farming to create soil. That soil becomes the new garden bed. They learn to germinate seed and plant seed into that garden bed, care for it, raise the crop, harvest the crop, learn to prepare that food. And, of course, we sit back down at the table again and eat that food, with any waste, of course, going back to composting once more. So they see the cycle of nature and embed it, as you were referring to before. If kids can experience this and understand it, it becomes part of their life skill. It becomes part of the way that they live, and we hopefully end up with a more sustainable planet.
I think that this is so fantastic. For any parents out there who are listening and maybe wanting their schools to get on board with some of the scrap initiatives, if they want to kind of start educating their kids about these things, how would you suggest they go about doing that?
Well, they can contact us. Our website can be made available. We've obviously contactable on by phone and email, and hopefully we can post those to your website.
Absolutely.
And get a greater group of people through to contact us. But yeah, we're always open to working with communities, working with households, not just schools and preschools and other educational organisations. And we do work with businesses as well.
That was Jess speaking to Peter Carroll.
Ubi Sydney are on a mission to bring you delicious, fresh, organic produce from local growers and deliver it to your door in one easy box. Pay our farmers fairly, with at least 50% of the retail value from your Ubi box going directly back into farmers' pockets. Join the movement now with $20 off your first Ubi box when you use the code 2SER at checkout. Visit ubi.org/Sydney. That's OOOBY. Four O's, one B and a Y. Ubi sponsors 2SER.
Now, we all know that type 2 diabetes is on the increase in Australia. There must be some fundamental reasons for that. Let's turn to a regular contributor, Russell Setright, who's a practicing naturopath in New South Wales, and look at the various options that are available. Now, obviously, Russell, when it comes to type 2, we always say that there are three things, and two of them have got to be wrong. They've got to be overweight, they've got to be lacking exercise, and highly stressed. But, of course, there are some other equations with this as well, aren't there?
Well, there are. Look, over the years, and I say over the years because I wrote about that in 2010, so that's 8 years ago,
yeah,
and that the evidence then was very strong, and it said that people with low levels of vitamin D had an 80% increased risk of developing diabetes. And this latest study, which looked at very high levels, which other studies didn't look at, and I mean extremely high. It's saying that the high level of 140, and we say that, you know, up to 80 is good. And the low level, we say if it's under 30 you're low, they're saying, well, under 70 was low. That's what they looked at. But they found that people who had lower levels compared to, in other words, under 70, were 500% more likely to develop diabetes than people with higher levels. And I went, wow, these are very high levels. But it again backs it up that diabetes and vitamin D can't be separated. They go along together because of the anti-inflammatory effect and all of the things that vitamin D has in the body.
But also, when you consider it, we're getting high levels here, and yet in Europe, where they don't get quite so much sun, they don't seem to have the same problem.
Yeah, but they don't have the deficiency of vitamin D that we have because they get out into the sun a lot more. They'll sunbake all day virtually without getting burnt, so that they're getting their levels of vitamin D. So we actually in Australia have higher levels of vitamin D deficiency, about 60% of people. Now, that goes along with darker-skinned people in Australia who have a higher level of diabetes than fairer-skinned people and a lower level of vitamin D than fairer-skinned people. So all of these things go together, but it's not the only thing. We know that putting on weight increases that risk, and high sugar levels also increase the risk quite dramatically. So it's very, very important that we put all of these things together and make sure that we're not looking at just one thing. I think the weight, the sugar, isn't it amazing it was all the fat 10 years ago, but now it's all the sugar. But it is, the sugar has always been a problem, and the carbohydrate proportions. We're not having enough protein. We're having too much carbohydrate, which of course is natural sugars. People have fruit, getting their sugars from that. And then they think that taking artificial sweeteners is going to solve the problem, but it doesn't. It tricks the body into putting your insulin levels up because it thinks you're having sugar.
Right. So it's actually counterproductive.
Well, it's probably productive in one way. Stevia is the only one I'd go with, the natural one.
Yeah.
All of the others have got potential to cause methanol in the body, which is toxic. The studies that they've done assume that no one's going to have very much, and it's nothing that's left. You leave cola drinks out in the sun, and they drink 2-4 litres in a day, which I can tell you a lot of people do, the workers on construction sites. They haven't allowed for that amount in the studies, and that's huge amounts of these artificial NutraSweet and so on. I think that there needs to be further studies on those, but the thing is to cut back on artificial sweetness as well. In other words, cut back on your sweet taste is what we need to aim at doing. If we do that, keep our weight down, we make sure our vitamin D levels are at optimum level, and that's around 75 to 80, I think that we can reduce the incidence of diabetes in Australia quite dramatically.
Well, there was a link also. We were talking about hot drinks with the Gulf War syndrome. They reckon about 700 troops, American troops, suffer a permanent damage after drinking warm Coke.
Exactly. That's right, particularly if it's been out in the sun.
Yeah.
You just got to be very... And of course, they don't shy away from that. They don't want it stored in the sun, and that's good. But unfortunately, sometimes in deliveries and when things happen, some things can get stored in the sun for longer periods of time, and that causes problems. I think what we've got to look at is limiting our soft drinks. Go back to the old-fashioned soft drinks we used to have, which was soda water. I remember we used to make our own soda water.
Yeah.
And squeeze a lemon into it or something like that, and it was very tasty, very thirst-quenching. And it hardly had anything. It wasn't like a huge amount of juice. Lemon or a lime flavours that soda water, and you cool that down, and it's a good drink. So, and then if we're going to have the odd one, I think that manufacturers are bringing down their sugar levels, and I think if they're looking at stevia and you have one every now and then, it's probably not a problem. But unfortunately, people who have these drinks tend to have them every single day.
Yeah.
And that is a problem.
If you've got a type 2 diabetes client, would you suggest they actually increase their vitamin D?
Absolutely. I'd say that based on all of these epidemiological studies and the actual clinical human studies as well, apart from anything, it's good for health. It reduces inflammation. It's linked with less multiple sclerosis, and that's a fairly good and solid studies.
Yeah.
It's linked with less cancer. Breast cancer, 30% less in women who have adequate levels of vitamin D. So what you're doing is recommending something pretty good, and if it helps them with their diabetes, along with weight management and diet control, it's all together. But I think what we're tending to do now is just say, just sugar.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I don't want to say just vitamin D. I want to say sugar, vitamin D, weight, and exercise all together would make a huge difference to the overall health of everybody, particularly in diabetes and heart disease.
Well, good advice, Russell. Russell's a practicing naturopath from New South Wales, who joins us most weeks. Russell, you have a great week, and we'll catch up next.
Thanks, Quentin. All the very best.
Enjoy what you're hearing? Help us to keep it coming. Our station's supporter funded. We rely on your generosity to continue producing the independent stories, ideas and music you love. You can support us anytime by heading online to 2SER.com/donate. Thank you for being part of the 2SER community.
After frustration caused by constant inhalation of secondhand smoke in his workplace, human resource manager of Eastlink in Victoria, Murray Keane, has introduced a policy to become a smoke-free workplace. Should managers be allowed to make this decision that impacts the workplace like this? And what is the next step from here? To discuss this, Nathaniel was talking to Kellyanne Jolly, the CEO of the Heart Foundation, on The Daily.
Is it within the rights of workplace managers to make smoke-free workplace policies such as this?
Look, I think it was very admirable for Murray Keane at Eastlink to actually, when he was walking to work, to see the number of smokers outside that he had to walk through, through the smokers to get to his office building. And as I think it was fantastic that he took that action to look at introducing smoke-free policies outside. And he's actually also tried to help those the workers there quit, and has had some great results. So that is a terrific outcome, and he's benefiting the health of those his co-workers. But I think a recent US study has really shown the harm that secondhand smoke can have on people. We all know about the harm of tobacco for smokers, but there's this study that has been done in the US that over 20 years and followed people over 3,000 people over 20 years has shown that secondhand smoke, if you don't have policies or legislation in place, that increases your risk of having cardiovascular disease. So we do know that that these policies and legislation does work, and particularly for secondhand smokers, this is one of the first studies that really has been able to demonstrate that. So while it's a terrific thing that Murray has done, and for his workers and for his organisation, we'd be really looking at how we can extend and fill some of the gaps in our smoke-free policies, so that he may not have to take that initiative himself, but it's something that everyone will have the benefit of.
Well, speaking about workplace policies, how effective would it be in reducing the risk caused by smoke exposure?
Well, that's what I think this study has really shown, even though it wasn't done in Australia, it was done in the US, that it has got, it can actually increase by not having these policies in place and by other people inhaling that smoke. It can increase the risk of cardiovascular disease quite significantly, in some cases, by a lot. And so if you actually have those policies in place, it can actually reduce by as much as 46% your risk of having cardiovascular disease, which is primarily stroke and heart disease. So it is quite, it can be very impactful.
Well, how do you think the majority of Australian smokers might react to this?
Look, I think one of the things that we've seen too is that across the country there are different policies and legislations in place, so it would be great for us to be able to be consistent across the country, and some states and territories have much greater and more policies such as this. So in Victoria and New South Wales, we don't have legislation around out for people who are in outdoor workplaces, outdoor drinking areas. We have it for outdoor restaurants and cafes. If you're eating outdoor dining areas, and we also don't have it in high roller rooms in gambling casinos and so forth. So there are a few gaps in the policies and legislations that are around. So it would be a great start if we can get some level of consistency across Australia in relation to this.
Now, Kellyanne, how worried should we be about the effects of secondhand smoke? Kind of going back to your point before.
Well, we still have 1 in 7 people still smoke. So it's still an issue in the community, even though we've seen great, strides. We've really improved in terms of the number of people and the percentage of the population that smoke, and we have got some significant policies and legislations in place. We've come a long way, but we still have 1 in 7 who smoke, so they're not only potentially harming their own health, but those around them. And so that's something that I think this study has really been able to demonstrate, that the impact that that can have if we are not introducing these policies and legislations that protect people around us as well as ourselves.
Well, if these legislations addressing the gaps in current smoke-free policies go through, how ahead of the game will Australia be compared to other countries?
Haven't got all that data in front of me, but I know there are some countries and some particular states of America who are ahead of us. So every country's at a different stages and in different places with this. So I think if we can get much more consistent and comprehensive policies across the country, I think we would definitely be out there leading the charge.
What would these policies look like?
Well, I think, as I said before, it's really around trying to ensure that we are protecting people from secondhand smoke and getting that consistency. So, for instance, as well as outdoor dining areas, we need to look at outdoor drinking areas, because if you're outdoors and you're drinking in a more confined space, that's important for the people who work there. So they're the workers who are there, and that's their workplace, and so that they're constantly being subjected, I guess, to smoke in their workplace. Where are others potentially, such as where I work, of course, at the Heart Foundation internally, there is a policy, there's policies and legislation around you can't smoke in my workplace, but people are subjected to smoke in other workplaces. So it's about being consistent and having that equity for people and workers. Those in some outdoor workplaces don't have that luxury of having that legislation or policies. People living in public housing are also, so there's some gaps. So I think it's about looking at how we can potentially, for want of a better term, plug the gaps, or look at where we've got some inequities around some of those policies, and looking at how we can ensure that all of our workers, particularly because it seems to be workplaces where this is of most mostly a problem, particularly for cardiovascular disease based on this study results. So it's important that we ensure that all our workers are able to be protected and have a clean air environment.
That was Nathaniel talking to Kellyanne Jolly, the CEO of the Heart Foundation Victoria.
107.3 FM. 2SER.
Instagram has become one of the most used social networking sites in the world. With over 700 million users, the photo-based platform has been traditionally skewed towards younger females aged 18 to 29 and has allowed people to interact with various online movements. Recently, the trend of clean eating has been heightened through the self-presenting nature of Instagram, and we have started to see men use it in a way to promote healthy eating habits and lifestyle. But what can this tell us about our current culture? Michael Walsh, Assistant Professor of Social Science at the University of Canberra, joined Brooke on Drive to discuss this.
And what exactly is clean eating?
Well, clean eating itself is actually a dietary practice that's kind of predicated on the consumption of foods that are perceived to be pure and clean. Tend to be things like that are unprocessed, unrefined, things that people perceive as nutrient-rich. But we were really interested, I suppose, more so in the visual presentation of these things, so, as opposed to the actual, dietary elements of this practice.
And the results of the research were very interesting. What was the process behind your research?
So the process behind the research was really taking the top posts that were associated with the hashtags of clean eating and eat clean over the week of a period, and we chose top posts in particular because those were posts that received visible attention and recognition by people that were actually using the hashtag. And so rather than looking at all of the posts under this particular hashtag, we just focused on those really kind of prominent images that were associated with the top posts. And essentially what we did was we got all of those posts over the period of eight days, and then we essentially coded those and perceived and looked at kind of what was our general theme. And I guess one of the really interesting things that we found from this actual project was that rather than food being the dominant or primary thing that was being posted, we actually found that bodies were presented, and in particular, we found that more men in particular were actually being presented associated with this hashtag.
Yeah, it definitely is an interesting find. And fitness and health-based Instagrams may be thought to be based more towards women. However, it's found that men are embracing this. So why are men suddenly become so interested in clean eating?
Well, I think there's actually an association between masculinity and very particular types of masculinity, which certainly are kind of hegemonical, hyper-masculine forms of kind of being a man, and that being associated with kind of a rational choice associated with certain types of dietary practices. And so there's this really interesting kind of dimension associated with clean eating, where we see images of men that are flexing, that are kind of in gym environments that are depicted kind of doing, you know, hard work in order to get results, so to speak. And so this is a real form of, I guess, meritocratic achievement conceptions of health being a responsibility of the individual.
And what does the rise in clean eating style, along with its self-presentation of Instagram, say about our current culture?
Well, I think it probably says something that we are much more aware of and presenting ourselves to our fellow people through social media, and that people take a lot more, I think, effort in actually presenting images to other people. But the other thing is that the actual recognition of posts that we found were really kind of, rather than being any old expression at all, they really conformed to, I guess, traditional gender stereotypes. And so that was quite interesting because we thought, you know, social media is a place where people can do what they like or kind of express themselves. So we actually found that rather than that, it was really conforming to typical gender stereotypes of what it means to be a man and also what it meant to be a woman.
Yeah, definitely. And you just talked about gender stereotypes. We've seen a lot of posts with men engaging in muscle presentation and flexing their arms. How might this affect ideas of masculinity?
Well, I think what it says is that if you want to indulge or engage, I should say, sorry, with this particular practice, this is the way you have to do it. And so it really kind of suggests that it subordinates other types of being masculine or being a man in this particular context. And so in some sense, it actually can be troubling for people that don't live up to those stereotypes of what it means to be and, you know, hegemonic masculine, as we call it in sociology. And that's quite interesting, I think, because, as we said, rather than being a kind of free expression, it's very much tailored to, I guess, more traditional versions of what it means to be a man or a woman.
Yeah, definitely. I do think it's interesting as well because, assuming the fact that it has kind of taken off as well, it's kind of presented in a way on a large scale as this is kind of now the gender norms and you should look like this. It should be. It's a little bit confronting as well. It can be a little bit of an issue for social as well.
When you don't conform to it either, right?
Exactly.
And that's kind of a big concern.
And I think as well, the fact that it has kind of increased in recent years as well, we have seen a big thing for clean eating. I think as well, it may be partly because it is on such a large scale now. We're talking before saying 700 million people do use Instagram. So it's especially if you have your page on public, there's millions of people that can view your stuff as well.
Absolutely. And the other really interesting thing also is that a lot of these posts are actually native advertisements as well. And so we often think of Instagram as being, you know, they're very visually focused and around the image. But what we actually also found was a lot of these posts were actually instances of people advertising products or services that weren't actually overtly apparent. So that's also another thing about Instagram that I think is less kind of apparent than, say, traditional media formats.
Yeah, exactly. We can see that all the time now, especially scrolling through our news feeds. You can often see celebrities endorsing, even if it's like a health protein powder, stuff like that. It has really taken off recently.
Absolutely. And health products and personal trainers and also food bloggers for that matter as well.
That was Michael Walsh, Assistant Professor of Social Science at the University of Canberra, talking on Drive. And that music means we're out of time. You've been listening to Panacea on 107.3. I'm Quentin Strawley. Let's make a date next week. Coming up is A Question of Balance.